Coming up on Outcast UK.
I couldn't not watch it because I had to know. I had to understand. I had to see. I had to be present in that moment because that was another milestone in the ongoing struggle that black people face with regards to racism.
I am an American. I am a black American. Black Americans, there's a certain level of culture that we bring to the table, a certain level of sauce that we bring to an experience.
Right. Sultan's got a rap
every single
said.
Every single night when I go to bed, he will like go nosh himself off in, because we had like a makeshift.
He would nosh himself off. Yeah, like, do you know what you just said there?
Yeah.
He would suck his own dick.
Yeah, because he could do that.
Fuck off.
Outcast UK with Graham Smith.
Before we go any further, Outcast UK has its live show coming at the London Podcast Festival, not far away now. It's a couple of weeks away. It's going to be on Friday, the 8th of September at the London Podcast Festival, King's Place in London, in the St. Pancras Room, where we are going to be having a roundtable discussion. I have got the controversial LGBTQ plus artist Liam Stoney McDonald having a bit of an artist talk with us. We're going to be chatting about his work. I've got Nick Charles in. You know my mate Nick. He is the podcaster, music producer, DJ. He's DJing at Fire. He's DJing everywhere. His DJing career is popping off. But he, just ahead of going off on his holes the next morning, is going to be joining us in London for that roundtable discussion. And our good friend Topher Taylor is on hand as well, helping out with some people's sexual needs. No, that doesn't sound right. Advice, sex advice and relationships advice. That was it. He's not going to be helping out with sexual needs unless certain criteria are fulfilled. You will find all the info to get your tickets. They're only £9 and it's not a massive venue and it's not a massive audience. You can be part of this show. £9 a ticket, I think that's right, about £9 a ticket. Head to playoutcastuk.com. That is playoutcastuk.com, and the ticket link is on there. Right now, the show.
This is the UK's hottest LGBTQ+ podcast. Outspoken. Outrageous. UK.
Welcome along to Outcast UK. It is the weekend of UK Black Pride in London, and on this special episode of Outcast UK, we are celebrating the voices, stories and perspectives of black queer people in the UK. Now, there is no singular voice to represent queer people of colour. It is obviously an incredibly broad community of people, but I wanted to bring some of the voices of actually some of my friends and family to Outcast UK for this special episode. Coming up, we've got a really personal insight into how the realities of structural racism came into our homes and relationships, whether we were ready or not. Told through the prism of my own experience in lockdown with my partner Steve, when we had to deal with societal structural racism off the back of the death of George Floyd. We're talking quite frankly about how we managed to navigate our way through that when we weren't expecting as a couple to deal with that. That's coming up. Also coming up as well, a quick check-in with Babo Sango, the queer rapper based in Los Angeles who loves UK Black Pride so much. He came over last year and he's come over this year and he's been performing in the days before in South London doing a gig there. We're going to catch up with him just as he gets on the plane to head off to UK Black Pride to hear a bit about the perspective of a queer person of colour from the US. And so, yeah, we're chatting to him as well. But first, let's start at the very beginning for this podcast. In the very first episode, if you've ever heard it, it's all the way right at the back of your news feeds, very beginning. The very first episode that I ever made, we caught up with someone who's become a really good friend of mine, Nick Charles. How many years ago was that now? 2020? It was 2020, I think that. So me and Nick have known each other like 3-4 years now, but we've known each other 6 months at this point, right? So he is making some big moves now with his DJing career. He's producing music as well. And this weekend he's busy gigging in Manchester before heading to London in the early hours of the morning. I think by 7 a.m. on Sunday morning, he will be DJing at Fire, which if you've ever been to Fire in Vauxhall in London, that is the point at which it is going off. That is when it's at its busiest. So he is DJing at that point on the weekend at the peak of UK Black Pride. He's also got his weekly national radio show on Gaydio, and he is the co-host of the Loud Brown Gays podcast with his bestie, Dan James. But Nick was born in Trinidad, and he had to leave there after a wave of anti-LGBTQ violence well over a decade ago. Was it 2009, something like that? About 2009, 2010. He lives in Manchester now, not far from me. He told us the story of why he had to move to the UK.
This is Outkast UK.
You ended up in the UK.
Yeah, like 11 years ago.
So that's a crazy story as well.
That's a crazy story.
And that's off the back of what was happening.
That was on the back of me like being in... So I went to... I was involved in a lot of like hate crimes back home. And I just had enough of it. And you know,
what
because
sort of thing happened?
Like, I remember this one, oh my God, this one specific thing. I was at a party with my friends one night, and these massive group of lads just ran into this gig. So in Trinidad, we used to have undercover gay nightclubs. So it was like, it was very much like Morse code. You had to know someone to know someone to know someone to gain. Because it was very much like underground.
Like the UK in like the 1950s or something.
Like, you know, like a really speakeasy kind of vibe. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. And I remember like these group of guys just ran into this party we was in. And you just seen glass bottles and bricks just being pelt, being thrown everywhere at everyone. And at a whole party, just gay people. Graham, I literally had to dive, roll and run for cover because it was like, it was literally an attack.
Did you feel like you were going to be killed or something?
Yeah, you know what? In my head,
that's it. Yeah.
I was like, yeah, okay, well, this is it. And you know what? I remember hiding behind like a crate, beer crate.
Yeah.
Hiding behind that and like toppling it down so like me and my friend could like hide. And I was like, if they show up here, because you don't know if these guys have guns or whatever. And I think to myself, we're going to death or die.
Yeah.
And I was like, this isn't for me. And I started to look into what do I do? Because at that time, like people around me are being killed. Like I've lost so many friends back home. Not only to like, you know, to sickness and disease, but also to like hate crimes. And I was like,
if you know people that are being killed from hate crimes.
Yeah, I know. I think I've lost about maybe 12 friends in my life back home to just being like killed.
I can't.
It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah. Back then you were either hearing at least one trans person being killed a day or a gay person being killed. And it was like, it becomes second nature eventually because you get so used to it, you don't know what to do. I remember I was going to funerals probably every other week for someone I know. And it was just like, and I had that moment where it just clicks and I was like, I am too young. This like, and at that time you start thinking, right, my lifeline is on a limit here. I don't think I'm gonna last very long, because at that time I wasn't out fully either. I was still, you know.
Do you think that's what was keeping you safe a bit?
Yeah, of course, because I was, you know, I was under that radar, flying really low, like, ooh, you know. And because of course, and I was very straight passing, not Mary fucking Poppins.
Nick does this thing with his headphones. He pretends he's got like a ponytail.
That's true in background. Yeah. But now it's like, yeah. And I feel like, so that was my safeguard because I was just passing. But there are people who was themselves and they were being killed. I remember the worst for me. Oh my goodness. The worst for me is like my friend Barry. Well, we're not friends anymore. But back then when we were friends, I remember we were inside at his house. And his car got stolen, right? Literally got stolen because he was like an MP and he was like a bit, he was out. And his car, and the next day they found his car, it was burnt. And the word, with the F word, that gay slur, was painted on it and burnt. All these things created this bubble. And I was like, I need to go. I need to just get out. So I was like, I literally just went to like the services back home. And I was like, what can I do to get out of this country?
Because who did you go to? Like
I went to like the embassy and stuff, and I was like, "What do I do? What do I do?" And they were like, "You know, you could like apply for like asylum and stuff if you think your life is at risk." And I was like, "It is at risk." That happened, and then they were like, "Okay, well, you know, the UK accepted the claim," and I was like, "I got given a 48 hours to leave my family and move." Now imagine I am 21.
And I've been 48 hours, get your shit together, get on a plane, go to London.
And you move, you're getting sent to London. Now in that moment, it becomes fight or flight because you have to think, you have to leave everything you have known behind. And remember, I am one of not many people who got that chance. because there are people back out there who was dying to get a chance, and I just happened to get that chance because, you know, they realized the situation at hand. And I remember like looking at my, like thinking to myself, I have 48 hours to say my goodbyes to my family. And that was hard.
How did you feel about leaving your family behind?
Do you know what?
Because that's quite complex, isn't it?
Do you know what?
What's happened?
This might sound really bad, but at that time I was like, you know, I need to go.
Yeah.
Because you know what it was? I was like, my family have lived their life and they're cushy because they're straight.
They're accepted.
They're
accepted.
I was like, I can't stay here. No, and I have friends dying around me every single day.
Yeah.
I was like, I need to go. And it was sad leaving my family behind, but then I had to think to myself, if I stay, I'm on limited time because I know for a fact if, like, today or tomorrow, I can get killed. And that's where reality hits in. Like, it's either you stay and you fly under the radar, or you leave and become who you have to be. And in that moment, I was like, yeah, I'm out of here. Then I think the other drama was in, you have to, because when you go through that Home Office claim, you have to prove that you're gay.
Right.
Oh, my days. And that...
Don't they often say, oh, but you could have just blended in at home, because that's what I've heard, isn't it?
Students, yeah,
they've said to people, just straighten it up a bit and don't act gay. How mad is that?
Yeah, they was like, oh, well, you know, and I'm just like, I'm not going to act any... I was like, I have done that for these past 21 years. I've acted straight for so long. Now I'm not doing it. And they... I'm telling you now, Graham, they ask you all the questions that you could think under the sun.
Like what? Go on, what sort of...
Oh, when was the first time you had gay sex? Did you like it?
Did you like it?
Yeah. That's the question they ask. Is it something you enjoy? Well, if I'm... Let me stop myself here. Let me just retrain my brain. No, if you think...
Imagine asking a straight person that was the first time you had sex with your wife. Did you enjoy it? It's like, well, fucking... Yeah,
what if she was shit? Well, what if she was shit in bed?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what they ask you. They ask you all these. I know it's really interesting, and I know that's how they work. They ask the questions in a different way to see if you're giving the same answer. So they'll ask you one question once, and then maybe in a month they will change the answer
in a different
interview.
Yeah.
And I probably had about 1,700 interviews, and the worst thing out of this was during the time when you're waiting for your claim to go through, you have to live off £35 a week.
You're not allowed to work.
You're not allowed to work. You can't go to school. You can't do anything. You just have to do.
What did you do?
Stay home and sleep. I mean, they put you in a nice house with a TV, but then you're sharing with
other... You get a TV in prison.
Well, that too. Yeah. But yeah, they put you in like a nice little house, and they put me in Bolton.
Wow.
Bolton. So they moved me from London to Bolton. But first, by the way, I was living in an immigration this like centre and stuff, because there's a lot of drama happening.
Detention centre.
Yeah.
Which one?
The one in Kent. It's shut down now.
That one.
Yeah. But it was, I will tell you this, the worst thing about being in those is, if you have a shower, please make sure you wear slippers.
Why?
Because everyone in that shower, because you're living in a combined, like you're sharing a room with like 8 other people.
Yeah.
Most of the men who used to live there will, you know, ejaculate in the showers. Oh. So you will literally go and have a shower and it's like...
Because they don't have a chance to...
Yeah, and it's like, this has happened. I am telling you now, there are many times I'll go and have a shower, I'm just like, oh, great.
You slipped on some spunk.
Literally. And it's like, it's worse how you know is because you'll be having a shower and the water just wouldn't go down because the hole's been covered with...
With jizz.
Imagine that. Imagine that. So it's like, oh, great. So not only am I in hell, I can't have a shower in peace because chances are there's spunk floating around. All these children is on the floor. Love that for me.
Wow.
So that's something.
Yeah. I don't know how to come back from that. When in immigration detention, always be careful you don't slip in the shower.
Yeah, love that. I mean, you don't have a choice because you don't get your own room.
Yeah, so it's otherwise...
Yeah.
Yeah, it causes
and
problems.
And men, we're men for God's sakes. What are you going to do?
Well, yeah. Especially when you can't, not much else to do.
Mm,
that's all I do.
I know. That's all you will do. It's like, all, I mean, to be fair, I know this is a bit off the topic, but in immigration center, you find the most fittest men. Oh my God.
Was this because you were just had nothing else to do? So you, when someone attractive did come and you were like,
there are many times I wanted to ride the faces of all the Brazilian boys. I would think to myself, I will ride you like a donkey. But then I'm like, at the same time, I'm in a detention center.
So people must have sex in detention centers. Of course they do, because people have sex in, it's a bit like being in prison, isn't it? It's like a kind of a prison.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
Well, we don't like to call it that, do
no,
we?
No, but then, but the thing is, right?
You've done nothing wrong.
You will have a solo room if you have like a mental disability or something like that.
Right.
But everyone else, you have to share. You're literally sleeping in like a 10-man room. It's a camp. It's like fucking camping.
Mm.
And you have to share a bathroom and all that. So it's like, you can, it's like, at the end of the day, you can't turn around and like, if there are chances are, you might turn around and someone might be getting themselves off because it's like, what do you do? It's, you know what? It's a ride.
Yeah. How long did that go on for though? How long were you living there, for example, when you arrived from Trinidad? How long were you living in immigration detention before they were like, right, we're going to send you to Bolton. Bolton's not a bad one either.
9 months?
9 months, wow.
9 months, yeah.
I've been on remand.
And you know what? And I will tell you this though, side topic. I ended up having a kind of like relationship in there with this boy. Now, he was straight.
Right.
And nothing happened. But...
what happened? Right. Sultan's got a rat though, you wouldn't
single
have said.
Every single night when I go to bed, he will like, go nosh himself off in, because we had like a makeshift.
He would nosh himself off. Yeah, like, do you know what you just said there?
Yeah.
He would suck his own dick.
Yeah, because he could do that.
Fuck off. No wonder you were keen. They were like, what's the trick he can do?
Yeah. So I was like, oh, love that for you. But yeah, so anyway, and then we had like a really good friendship, and then after I came out and stuff, and he was like, oh, when you go, would you go see my wife? And I'm like, oh God, no, not this.
Oh, really?
Not a wife. I was like, does she know you could do this? No. Makes sense.
That's such a story.
But that's
so many layers to that story. It's immigration detention, auto fellatio.
Yeah, layers. Love that.
Amazing. Outcast UK. There we go. My mate Nick Charles there. And he is, he's smashing it now. I love that story at the end, by the way. It still makes me laugh. The immigration detention story. It was a proper curveball. No one saw it coming. You can catch his podcast, The Loud Brown Gays Podcast, hear him every week on Gaydio. Check him out on Spotify and search for him on Instagram as well. He never fails to deliver on there. And this is a special episode of Outcast UK that I have made, throwing together a load of the voices of queer people of colour and their perspectives from some of the highlights of the show over the course of the last three seasons. Coming up, a chat I had with my partner, Steve, about the effect of the murder of George Floyd on our relationships. And you can hear the full Nick Charles chat, the very start of the Outcast UK feed. And if you scroll back about 6 months, about January, around about then, at the start of this year, 2023, you'll hear the full chat I did with Steve. In fact, it was across a few episodes, so that's some stuff that you can look back to. And also, if you've been listening to Outcast UK the last week or so, you'll have heard me talking to Babo Sango, and he is a queer rapper from Los Angeles who really owns his queerness in his rapping. And he gets referred to as the male Nicki Minaj. I mean, I loved his music, but and I was nervous about meeting him, because you always are when people are kind of that cool, especially when they're described as the male Nicki Minaj. But to meet him, he was one of the most sound people I've had on the show in absolutely ages. It was a joy to chat to him. So this is a bit of our chat from earlier this week, just as he was about to get on the plane from Los Angeles to London to come to UK Black Pride, where of course he was performing this week in London, and his opinions on the different experience for queer people of colour and actually people of colour in the UK versus the US. Outcast UK. You're in LA right now, and then you're going to jump on a plane, and then 13 hours later you land in London, and you've already said that the UK, you felt seen in the UK. Now, not everyone says that. Not all people of colour that I know say that. Some people say they feel more like at home and seen and comfortable in the US.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you said that. You said you kind of prefer the UK like that. Why is that?
As of right now, and listen, you know, I love being an American. Let me be, you know, very blunt about that and upfront. I love being American. I wouldn't be who I am the type of freedoms that we do have, regardless of the amounts of stuff that, you know, Black Americans, we have had to endure for centuries. I do appreciate being an American because there are certain things and freedoms that I can do that I can't do in other parts of the planet. A wide variety of certain freedoms that aren't allowed for any American in other parts of the planet, regardless of your sexuality. So let me start there. I love being an American. However, you know, I've been to the Midwest. I've lived in the South. I've been to the East Coast. I've lived on the West Coast, and yeah. I've never felt more at home than when I was in London last year. And I don't know. I think it has a lot to do with I look different. I sound different. You know, I am an American. I am a Black American. Black Americans, there's a certain level of culture that we bring to the table. Certain level yeah. of sauce that we bring to an experience, regardless of whether you're a Southern Black American, a West Coast Black American, whatever. When we enter into a space, there's a certain level of, ooh, who's that? Let me, you know. So I'm not naive. I know that that's there. And who's to say that maybe me visiting is different from me living? But what I will say, you know, living there. But what I will say is my experience when it comes to networking, when it comes to just people relations, it's my experience in London has been a lot better than my American experience. I think there's just a lot of, ooh, what can you do for me? And what's your budget type stuff in America? It's money, money, money. It's me, me, me. And my experience in London was not necessarily money, money, money. Nobody wants to do nothing for free. But also it's like, oh, if you can, hey, like this show, I booked that myself. I knew the owner. I said, hey, I can bring an audience. It's UK Black Gay Pride Week. Would love to create a safe space for people to come and network and get a show, catch a vibe. And they were, and he was obliged to do that. Like, I wouldn't be able to do that in America without having to give something up. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. I can't put my thumb on it, but.
But you feel welcome on that. I think welcome. That's good.
Yeah.
So they do say, I've read this so many times, that the kind of racism that people of colour experience in the UK is a different kind of racism to the one that people of colour experience in the US. How much do you reckon that's true?
I think it's 1,000% true. Again, I'm not naive to, I think every Black American from a very young age, whilst you're learning your ABCs, you're at the same time learning whether or why, you know, whether somebody likes you or doesn't like you because of the color of your skin. This is an elementary beyond, you know, you can, oh, they don't really, oh, and then you just start adding up the, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. Oh, they don't like me because of my skin, you know, that's instantly, this is elementary. We're learning these things.
Yeah.
So we are able to read people very well. And, you know, I think the racism that, when I was in the UK, I didn't experience any racism. If I did, it was nothing that was noticeable or nothing that was deterring my day, messing up my day, getting in the way of anything I had going on. I feel like it's a conversation in the UK that would happen. Maybe there's a level of disrespect. Maybe you have a conversation about it. Maybe we don't agree because not everybody's going to be a cup of tea. You're not going to be friends with everybody. Yeah. And it is what it is. If somebody doesn't like you in the UK because of the color of your skin, hey, we don't want to hang out with you. Cool. I got a group of people I can hang out with, right? The difference, one of the main differences is in the States, if somebody doesn't like you for the color of their skin, color of your skin, they're trying to remove you from existence.
Yeah, they want you out of society, full stop. Yeah.
Not only do we not want you, not only do we question your why you exist, but also why are you here? You don't deserve to be in this nice area of town. There's a systematic form of racism that exists in America. Mm-hmm. Not only are we not allowing you, you know, access to funds and financial freedoms or, you know, loans or, you know, housing, but we're, you know, there are certain people that are literally trying to take you out. You know, I encourage you, if you haven't already, check out the 13th documentary on Netflix by the beautiful, talented, and smart Ava DuVernay. it explains perfectly why, you know, America has the most prison systems on the planet. You know, it was like the 13th Amendment was like a loophole for people to be able to still have slavery. Oh, slavery doesn't exist unless you, you know, have been convicted of a crime.
Yeah.
So if you've, you know, if you're in jail, oh, then we can
then
strip
you do
away.
Hard labor in jail. Yeah.
Hello. Hello. Yeah, so yeah. There, I mean, I'd encourage everybody to check out that documentary if you haven't already. But yeah, it's just, again, love being an American. But at this stage in my life, when we're talking about career, when we're talking about significant other, we're talking about starting a family, I see myself doing that more in you know, outside of my country, anywhere outside of my country than within, because I know how to navigate the space in America. Yeah. Watching, you know, make sure I'm driving correctly, speed limit, all of that, make sure I'm doing this and that. I can't say the same. I can't say I would feel the same about my own children when I start to have them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to have to. You're going to always worry about your kids, but I would feel more at safe or more safe if I was, you know, to begin a family, you know, outside than
right. With, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in the US at the moment, and we'll move on from this in a second, but I just want to know what you think about this. You're looking at like potentially like Trump coming back next year. How does that make you feel? Because he is not on our side collectively. And I'm almost certain he's not on the side of queer people of color. How does that make you feel?
You know, when it comes to Trump, you know, I think he's, my thing with Donald Trump was when he got elected, I was like, wow, that's so American. Like, that is the American dream, to have zero qualification to be the leader of the free world and you become the president of the United States. Anything is truly possible. If that ain't America, I don't know what is, right?
yeah, totally,
you know,
totally.
That's one thing, you know, Black Americans, we're gonna find something to laugh about. We're gonna try to make something happy out of a negative situation.
Outcast UK.
On this special episode of Outcast UK, we are celebrating the voices and perspectives of Black queer people in the UK. That's a difficult thing for me to do, a white guy in his late 30s, very late 30s. So it's a tricky one for me to do in a lot of respects. So all I can really do and be authentic about it is bring you the experiences of my friends, my partner, my partner's family. They're all the most important people in the world to me, really. So that's what I'm trying to do here. And I'm bringing you conversations that I've had with some of my favourite queer people of colour, who happen to be my partner and one of my best mates as well. So that's what we're doing on the show today. This episode is a special serving of some of the Black queer perspectives from the people I love most in the world, my friends and family. It doesn't get much more personal than that. And it doesn't get much personal than this chat that I had on the podcast about 6 months ago with my other half, Stephen, about how the brutal murder of George Floyd in the depths of COVID in 2020 brought the reality of structural racism right into our home for the very first time.
Outcast UK with Graham Smith.
As a white person, I feel like a lot of us didn't know how to respond. Should we go... through how it was in our house?
Yeah,
because it was a. I'm not going to say we fell out because we didn't fall out.
No, I think we were misaligned in the course of events, and we were misaligned on the impact that it had on me, us, my family, my community, people of my ethnicity. And, you know, with hindsight, I think we're both clear and we both understand how that misalignment happened.
I didn't want to...
Let's be honest, we'd had a heavy weekend, so not...
So blocked both, out the world.
So heads weren't necessarily in the game.
Yeah.
You know, you were quite severely hungover, as was I. So, you know, emotions are heightened. Mine, I'm more sensitive to the impact of what I saw. You know, I'd sat and watched the entire 9 minutes, is it?
I've never watched it.
Well, I couldn't not watch it. because I had to know, I had to understand, I had to see, I had to be present in that moment, because that was another milestone in the ongoing struggle that black people face with regards to racism.
It took me a week because I didn't want you upset, if I'm honest. And it sounds mad. I knew it was going in the news, thought we'll talk about this, but I hadn't realised the impact on you. And I don't think a lot of white people did. I just wanted us to be happy, if I'm honest. The ultimate sort of something that sums up how a lot of white people felt was like, remember when my mum come round and she give you some flowers? Was it chocolates? I can't remember. But it's the sort of thing that you do when someone's lost a member of their family, and it's kind of cute, but that's not what you were after. Because she doesn't know how to react, so she does that. Yeah.
It was cute, and look, it was her way of saying, I've thought about you, and I recognise this has had an impact on you, but also it was clear she didn't really know how, why, or what to do.
Where to begin, yeah.
And look, and that's the reality of a lot of these social conversations that we have. So let's just take a step back from George Floyd for a second and look at Sarah Everard, you know, the young woman who was murdered by a serving police officer in London. Now, I know for certain, and again, as part of my work, actively talking about DEI, and we'll come onto that in a second, in the workplace. But, you know, I have to, and I want to, and I consciously make the effort to understand, to engage, to learn more about the impacts of injustices on identities throughout, you know, the communities and the society within which we live. And when Sarah Everard was murdered, I saw a physical and visual reverberation. You know, a bit like cartoons where something happens and there's a dying and then you see like the sound wave travel. It was like I could see it happening in society. And women around me, workplace, friends, acquaintances, colleagues, random people on Twitter and social media, they were hurting, they were fearful, they were making the point that this is something that's been a problem since the day dot. Women have always had a problem feeling safe as they move through our society, especially at late nights, especially in circumstances and situations where they are more vulnerable. It shouldn't be that, but that is the case. So when Sarah Everard was murdered, there was a complete understanding within women in our society about the dangers that scenarios such as Sarah's could present to them. And I feel that's a good parallel to maybe help some other people who aren't black, who aren't an ethnic minority, to understand how an entire community can reverberate around an injustice. You know, I saw George Floyd killed by the knee of a police officer. And 2 years later, I was on a train, and I don't probably have time for this story now, but a long story short...
You have... No, go on. You've got time for this story.
Okay.
Because this is an important one, because a number of people have heard this.
So, after lockdown, I'm on the train down to London. It's an early morning train, like an 8 a.m. number. So, you know, I bounce straight out of bed, shower, boom, taxi, I'll get some food on the train. Get on the train. It's engineering works, yay. So it's a 3.5 instead of a 2-hour journey. And bing bong, sorry, shop's not working. No, specifically the card machine's not working. So it's cash only. So I'm like, crap. I've only got cards. So I bounced to the buffet car and I said to the guy, look, you know, obviously I understand the card machine's not working. What are the normal options in these types of scenarios? Because this must happen on a fairly regular basis. What are the options? Nothing. Right, okay. Because I haven't eaten and, you know, it'll be lunchtime by the time we get there and I'm quite hungry. Is there a cash machine on a platform in a train station that we're going to go through that might be, we might be there for a couple more minutes that I could dive off and nope, can't do that. So I'm like, right, okay. So I'm walking back to my seat and I walk past a table with people eating. So I thought, ah, they've obviously got cash because it's all, you know, branded from the train. So I said to the guy, look, really awkward. I've got no money. Do you have cash? Do you have internet banking? Can I transfer you in front of your eyes money into your bank account if I can have some cash from you, please? Fine. Absolutely fine. And I was like, yeah, we had a little laugh about it. It was all good. Went back to the car, to the buffet car, ordered my food. He was like, you know, this is a cash only bar. I was like, yes, I know. Ordered my food. And then gave him a £20 note. And he said, this isn't legal tender. And I looked at him. Now, we'd been in lockdown. I hadn't touched cash. And this sounds really weird. I hadn't touched cash for like a year because, you know, as part of early phase of COVID, everything was don't touch, don't touch, don't touch. So it was all cashless, cashless. I'm going literally to Tesco and back home. That was the sum existence of my life and operating and paying with money. So what happened, the guy on the train had given me an old style £20 note. And of course, the £20 notes had changed into the polymer ones that we now are familiar with the slight see-through thing. And
I wouldn't even know.
It just didn't occur to me.
I wouldn't know.
So I said, oh, okay. And then the guy says, so, yeah, obviously, this, you know, this isn't legal tender. So I said, okay, well, give me a second. And I went back down the train to the guy that had given me the £20 note who I'd transferred £20 into his bank account and said to him, sorry, mate, the shop guy's saying that this isn't legal tender. And he turned around and said, look, it is. He said, the notes are starting to go out of circulation, but they're valid until September. And this was like March or something. So I was like, okay. So I went back to the buffet car.
Coach C.
Yes, it is Coach C, actually. And I said to him, so, I'm sorry, but the guy that I got this note from also paid you with the same notes because he showed me his wallet. He had like 15, £20 notes. And the guy was still kind of, I don't know how to describe it, just acting shady.
So the guy that you got the money off was white?
Yes.
Yeah.
So he was white with his female partner or travelling companion. I don't know who she was. But look, so the long story short here is white man uses old £20 note, fine, pays for, gets food. Black man with the same wad of £20, same £20 note, goes to the guard. The guard holds the money behind the thing. This is it. Also, before I went back to see the guy down the train, he then says, I'm going to call ahead to the station to ask my line manager if this is legal tender. And the way that he said, I can't describe this, and I'm normally quite an articulate person, it was like he was de facto accusing me of using fake out-of-date notes, calling ahead, picked up the phone, calling whoever he was calling to see whether this was legal tender and whether it could be accepted. In this meantime, I'm on my phone thinking, shit, am I in trouble here? And at that moment, George Floyd went through my head. Because George Floyd, I remember correctly, was arrested for having a counterfeit $20 note. And at that moment, everything played forward because as a black person, you know how these things get escalated. There's videos all over social media. I showed you the one of the other day of those two young black boys going to private school in Bromley, just down the road from where my mother lives and I grew up. And one 14-year-old boy, no, hang on, no, he was 15 because he was going to do his mock GCSEs, which he missed, was manhandled, held up against the wall by four train personnel, one of them with his hand around the child's neck. The child's crime? He'd forgotten his travel card. And they called the police on two 14-year-old boys. So I know of 15-year-old and 13, I think, brothers. So I know how things escalate when you're black. I know what people in society do to you when you're black. Mm-hmm.
And even if there was no risk of that on the train, everything that's gone on is making you feel like that could happen, isn't it? Even if there is no immediate risk, the amount of stuff that we're seeing now is playing out in your head. So if you're feeling anxious or uncertain in a situation, then there's that as well.
Well, and look, but how do I quantify or assess the risk?
Because
the other thing, again, this I really should have thought about this story before I started saying it. It came to me as we were talking. At this point, the guy's on the phone talking to whoever he's talking at. Bing, bing, we're now pulling into XYZ. So these are the things that my mind goes through. George Floyd got killed because a £20 note. We're coming into a station now. What if this guy is one of those guys that needs to assert himself and show me who's boss? What if he's calling British Transport Police? What if the British Transport Police are then going to come on the train and haul me off the train as we pull into this station? And then what happens? And then I've got no money. Who do I communicate with? I'm on the train by myself. I'm a 30-something-year-old man, and I'm shitting myself about what might happen when this train gets into the platform in the next 5 minutes. Now, thankfully, for some reason, having done his show of whatever the fuck he was doing a show of, it's okay. I've spoken to my manager and it's fine. So I paid for my food and I just about to step away. And I said, I'm sorry. But what is it about me that went through all of this when I got this note from somebody who's already used similar notes to buy the food on the train? What is it about the black man that meant that you needed to pick up the phone and start making a big deal of this? Oh, well, I said, not to worry, you have a good day, and just walked away. But that's not a micro, that's a macro aggression. But those things happen to people regularly. Mm-hmm. Those things happen to black people all the time. So, can't remember how we got into this now. George Floyd.
George Floyd. And the point being, George Floyd was the thing that started us as a society thinking about racism in particular, and then people broaden it out at some point to other injustices, you know, like they do on Sky Sports when they sort of gloss over the racism. So it's for all bad things.
Take a knee for racism and everyone that had a bad time.
Yeah. But that's what started people thinking about it, was the George Floyd moment. I mean, and you can see the changes in organisations everywhere now. Any organisation worth their salt now is getting ahead of this. And you're unique in that you're interested in the whole spread of DEI because of your experiences as a gay black man living in the UK. The intersection of those two identities means that you're often subject to fairly specific negativity sometimes, and also sort of airbrushed until more recently, sort of airbrushed from visibility. Remember when you first met my nan, and she was like, oh, he's black as well. And we were like, yeah, this was 2005, by the way. But there is that experience for black gay people in the UK, and I feel like that George Floyd was the moment when we started to think about these things. Now, I could never find the mental strength to sit through the death of George Floyd. We said this last week, and in itself, I think that's a kind of form of a white privilege, isn't it, as well? I thought that myself. So Los Angeles police officers stopped 31-year-old Keenan Anderson following a traffic accident on January the 3rd in Los Angeles. He is the cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors, and he died after his interactions with the LAPD. They released body camera footage. He's a 31-year-old high school teacher and a father visiting LA from Washington, D.C. There's been a number of incidents in LA recently. There's been a number of people killed after interactions with police officers. 45-year-old Takar Smith, 35-year-old Oscar Sanchez, both of whom were fatally shot by officers. So this is at Venice in California. He's been detained by multiple officers. And a quick heads up, this content might be distressing for some people. So you might want to fast forward like 30 seconds if you struggle to listen to evidence of police brutality against people of colour.
Keenan, relax! Keenan, relax! I'm gonna tase you! Turn over, I'm gonna tase you!
Please! Please!
I'm gonna tase him!
They're trying to kill me! They're trying to kill me! Leave me alone!
Stop it!
Already on the internet, people are trying to point the finger of blame at the victim there. That man died 4 hours later in hospital. The police have already put out a toxicology report and they've said that he had marijuana in his system and they found traces of whatever. And that's being used as an excuse by commentators, largely on Twitter, who were saying the officers were just doing their job. And a man's face down on the floor and they repeatedly electrocute him.
But again, this is another example of how disproportionate force is used against a black person, this time another black man. It's another good example also of how institutions will take actions to discredit the victim of, in this case, I mean, what do we call it? Do we call it murder? Do we call it manslaughter? I mean, I think we're probably, unfortunately, still in the early aftermath of it. So let's just say, let's be neutral and say a man has died.
Yeah.
His most recent action before dying was being tasered by police. Now, what did I see in that video? I saw a man who is clearly distressed.
Yeah.
From the get-go, he's distressed. Something's not okay. He's scared of the police.
Understandably.
He specifically references George Floyd. In the video, you can see one of the officers with his elbow, I think it is, yeah, on Keenan's neck.
Where his mate say stop doing that.
Further into another video, I think he says elbow partner. One of the officers tells his partner to remove his elbow from Keenan's neck. So, you know, the releasing of the toxicology report, I'll stand corrected if someone can prove this otherwise, but that's not normal. It's not the immediate due process that organisations go through, police go through when they start to understand and investigate what's happened in these kind of scenarios. So, again, what we see is another example of an institution rallying around to protect itself through another incident that has another incident that has disproportionately impacted the life of a black person. And, you know, the discrediting of the individual, you know, we saw it with Chris Cabba. And when Chris Cabba was followed by
an unmarked vehicle
in London for, I believe, about 15 minutes before being pulled over, no identification, no police officer identified themselves as being police. Armed police got out of their car and one shot was fired into his head and he was killed. So he was executed
through his front window. Yeah.
And in the days afterwards, again, the story, he's connecting him to drug dealer, something, you know, the generic discrediting of the individual.
Which they always do in these situations. Like the Met's done it before and we see it all the time. It's a policing tactic when they're in the wrong, isn't it? I mean, if I was to take you back to the Hillsborough disaster in the UK in 1980. 9. The immediate response when they knew that they'd done something wrong was to blame people, saying they're drunk.
Yeah, blaming the victim.
This is Outkast UK.
So if you want to hear any of the interviews that you've just heard over the course of the last 48 minutes or so, you can check them out. Nick Charles, you'll find him in our first few episodes. You go right back to the start of the feed, a couple of episodes with Nick. A few episodes with my other half, my fiancé, soon to be my husband. We will be wed. Sounds very sort of Victorian, that, doesn't it? A few episodes with him from the start of this year that you can check out. And Babo Sango was on earlier this week. So if you enjoyed that couple of minutes you heard of a chat between me and him, you can hear a much longer version just a few episodes back. We will see you for our next episode drop, in which will be in about a day or so, with another Queer News update with Kev McGrath. Until next time, take care and enjoy your UK Black Pride.
Play Outkast UK.